Blog Talk Radio.
Today we'll be reading from the American Association of Retired Persons Bulletin, The New Faces of Caregiving. People across the country take up the challenge. Here are their stories. The demands and rewards of dementia patients. There are more than 15 million family and friends who provide care to people with dementia, according to the Alzheimer's Association. Most say they experience very high levels of emotional stress. The challenges are very different from those faced by the average caregiver. For one, there's the emotional toll that comes with, as Drew puts it, watching someone you're very, very close to lose their, just not just their memory, but their personality, their sense of humor, their ability to care for themselves, all the things that make people who they are. There's also the fact that someone with dementia can require caregiving for years. Ken Takia, 71, of Kalawu, Hawaii, whose wife of almost 48 years has dementia, manages stress by sharing his story with other caregivers, encouraging them to seek respite care and to understand that feelings of resentment are normal. Every caregiver would get frustrated, including myself. Ken's caregiving journey started 10 years ago when his wife Charlotte, who was having memory problems, was misdiagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. They discovered 6 years later her steadily worsening dementia was a symptom of a normal pressure of hydrocephalus, or water on the brain. The years it went untreated caused serious brain damage. Charlotte, now 71, has since had surgery, and while she still has trouble communicating, she can now walk with assistance, Ken says. She's getting better slowly. She's eating regular food now and can recognize more and more people. He regularly monitors things like her temperature, blood pressure, oxygen level, and has a video camera trained on her when she goes to sleep at night. He plays her favorite music nearly 24 hours a day, brushes her teeth, crushes her pills into applesauce to get them down easily, and walks her to the bathroom. Their two adult sons have moved home to help out, and Ken gets further help from a senior care center where Charlene spends 4 days a week. During the time, he volunteers as a caregiver educator, reaching out to others like him who need resources and advice. To others whose loved ones have dementia, he says it's nothing to be ashamed of, and second, just do the best you can. If you try to be too perfect, you're going to just frustrate yourself. Millions of millennials giving back. Members of the millennial generation, ages 18 to 34, have a reputation for being self-involved. But the estimated 10 million millennials caring for adult family members certainly don't fit that mold. About 25% of U.S. caregivers fall into that age range, according to the AARP caregiving report. There are challenges that these young caregivers face, a social worker for cancer care. Often they have little or no experience with serious illness, with making important health care decisions and dealing with insurance. Many are also long-distance caregivers in new careers and feel tremendous guilt when they can't visit their loved ones. Support groups can be helpful, though there aren't many focused on this age range, which facilitates caregiver groups for ages 20 to 30 in New York and online at cancercare.org. But having even one person in a similar situation to confide in is critical. I hear again and again, no matter how well-intended they are, their friends or other people close to them just don't get it. Hannah Roberts, 28, has often logged into cancer care support group since her mother, Carla Johnson, 62, was diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer last spring. I don't think many people in my age group have experienced anything like this, so that can be isolating. It's hard to see them on a Facebook and going on with their normal lives. She's taken a year's leave from her third year at Columbia University Medical School, moved from New York into her parents' home in the Boston suburb to care for Johnson. She drives her mother to medical appointments. Hold on a second, that turned page. She drives her mother to medical appointments, organizes nursing visits, helps prepare meals while her dad has taken on more tasks at the architectural firm the couple founded. Another difficult part of the caregiving role, she says, is not worrying about the professional and personal goals I have put on hold. Because patients diagnosed with this particularly aggressive form of cancer have months, not years to live, I'm really trying to be in the moment with my mother. Roberts is also working on cancer research project at the Boston Hospital, where Johnson goes for chemotherapy treatments and is aware of the coincidence of her specialty, radiation oncology, a field she chose 2 weeks before her mom's diagnosis. It's been quite surreal, she said. If there's any good to come out of this experience, Roberts says that as a physician, she'll be more attuned to the needs for patients, caregivers, and understand that challenge. It's definitely emotional, but it's also logistical. Just everyday tasks that have to be done and putting yourself second. Hold on, time for a drink of water. Okay, dealing with veterans' invisible wounds. Feeling isolated can be a problem for any family caregiver, but maybe more so for the 5.5 million caregivers of veterans and current members of the military, about 17% of all caregivers. Sometimes I feel as though people in the military can understand what it's like to be a veteran. A high proportion of these caregivers, 68%, consider their situation highly stressful. The good news is the Veterans Administration now has what Hunt describes as the most comprehensive program for caregivers in the country. Thanks to Caregivers and Veterans Health Service Act of 2010, the legislation authorized the VA to implement a broad range of services for those caring for veterans and members of the military seriously injured in post 9/11, such as paying qualified caregivers the amount that a home health aide would cost. But the 1.1 million family caregivers of post 9/11 veterans and military members, about only 22,000 are receiving this extensive assistance, generally those faced with the most severe physical injuries. The eligibility is very limiting, said Stephen Schwab, executive director of Elizabeth Dole Foundation, which works to raise awareness and support military family caregivers. We're partnering with the Veterans Administration to explore extending support, but it will take Congress to change that. For Alice Arnold, 69, and her veteran husband, D.W., 65, services make a big difference. She met D.W. in 2008, 3 years after he was injured in a mortar attack while serving an Army chief warrant officer in Iraq. He broke a knee and both ankles, cracked disc in his spine, and suffered a traumatic brain injury in the explosion. Now D.W., who lives with Alice in North Carolina's Outer Banks, is considered fully disabled. He walks with a cane, has short-term memory loss, and post-traumatic stress disorders. Sometimes he wakes up yelling at night and is quick to anger. These are the invisible wounds, and they're the worst part, Alice says. But his meds and regular psychiatric consultations through VA keep his moods relatively stable. The VA is paid to build a more accessible bathroom and lift in their small house, has provided training for the Alice periodic care, a home health aide for hours, 4 hours a week, twice a week, and free medications, who served in Vietnam as well as, DW served in Vietnam as well as Iraq. We've been blessed, Alice said. We've had the best care we can get from them. The couple was able to spend quality time sitting by the ocean, watching movies and eating out. I wouldn't trade my life for the world, she says. It helps that she has no qualms about requesting the assistance that she feels they deserve. He earned it, she says. She encourages other caregivers of veterans to be just as assertive. You're not used to asking for help, but you have to swallow that pride sometimes and ask. Taking on a complex medical task. Caregiving is a difficult, it's difficult under any circumstances, but it's gotten even more difficult in recent years as more caregivers take on complex tasks once performed by doctors and nurses. In fact, 6 out of 10 caregivers perform such tasks, according to new findings from Caregiving in the U.S., a report jointly prepared by AARP and the National Alliance of Caregiving. More than 4 in 10 say they've received little or no training. That places an enormous burden on them, physically, psychologically, even spiritually, says Matthew Calzo, Executive Director of Supportive Care and Medicine at City of Hope, a cancer research and treatment center in Duarte, California. The reason for increased burdens are varied. Medicine itself has become vastly more complex with new medications, new ways to deliver them, increasingly sophisticated procedures to ease pain and prolong life. Patients are being released from the hospital much earlier than in the past. In 1980, the average hospital stay was 7.3 days. Today, it's just 4.8 days. That's slowly changing. New Medicare regulations penalize providers when patients have to be readmitted to the hospital within 30 days, adding a powerful incentive for the healthcare system to give patients and caregivers the practical support they need to make the transition from hospital to home. Meanwhile, a handful of initiatives are filling the void. The Rosalind Carter Institute for Caregiving recently released free training webinars on all aspects of caregiving. San Francisco-based Family Caregiver Alliance has posted instructional caregiving videos on YouTube, and major medical centers are producing print and video instructions. But much more needs to be done. We have to recognize increasingly demanding work that family caregivers do, and provide practical help at every step of the way. Okay, I turn page. Magazine's not easy to keep up with. Well, I think it's time for another drink of water. Hold on a second. Traditionally female role. Oh, family caregivers are predominantly women, only 40% of men, according to the AARP National Alliance for Caregiving report. The gender gap is narrowing. Just 6 years ago, surveys found that only 34% were men. While male caregivers face many of the same challenges, they also tend not to have strong networks of support. That means they're more vulnerable to stress and stress-related illnesses, including depression. Surveys have shown that between 40 to 70% of caregivers have significant symptoms of depression, and men are far more likely to seek treatment. Marcus Walker, 56, is one male caregiver who doesn't have much of a support network. A full-time mail handler for the U.S. Postal Service, he spent the past 14 years in Chicago living with and caring for his mother, Melinda Butler, 83. She's had rheumatoid arthritis for decades, but 4 years ago her spine became infected after a spinal tap and it nearly killed her. She never really recovered from that, he said. Today, Waller explained, she's my light and my darkness at the same time. He loves her, of course, but he often feels resentful that so many of his own needs are being subsumed by hers. Evenings follow a familiar pattern. As soon as she gets home from work, she gives his mom dinner and her meds, including eye drops now that arthritis has affected her eyes. Then he encourages her to exercise by riding a stationary bike or walking up and down the block. They relax in front of the TV. They both like The Walking Dead, he said, zombies and witches and stuff like that, before he helps her take a shower and she gets her to bed. What's tough is that Butler can be moody and demanding. I get depressed, he admits. Sometimes I don't want to go home. I just want to drive on by. Though he's never considered attending a caregiver support group, he didn't even know they existed. Waller says he handles the stress his own way, sometimes by performing poetry, which he writes, and singing at various venues around town. It's a crucial outlet for blowing off steam and expressing himself, he says. It lifts me up mentally and spiritually. I do whatever it takes. Poetry is a mental relief. I wouldn't know anything about that now, would I? Squeezed between two generations with needs. Nearly half of all adult caregivers are younger than 50, according to AARP. Many on the older end of this range are members of the sandwich generation, which 40-somethings whose energies are focused both on school-aged children and parents. Grace Estrada, 47, a single mother of two in Claremont, California, became her parents' caregiver several years ago. It happened gradually, she says. For a while they were helping me, and at the same time I was helping them. Her Mexican-born mother, Mercedes, 75, and her father, Gilbert Estrada, who passed away 2 years ago, watched her children while she went to graduate school and later her job as a social worker. And at some point, Grace realized that their roles had quietly reversed. Now she and her kids, ages 10 and 12, share their home with Mercedes, whose health issues include diabetes, restless leg syndrome, frequent migraines, serious arthritis, and a thyroid problem. Mercedes is fine at home alone for a few hours at a time, but Grace checks in frequently by phone. She assists her mother every day with tasks such as bathing and dressing and keeps track of her complicated mix of medications. And every evening, Grace, Mercedes, and their children, Jeremiah and Isaiah, take a walk through the neighborhood. Grandma using her walker, the family dog alongside. Grace has six brothers, the only one lives nearby, so she bears full weight of caregiving, a fact that she says her mother appreciates. She said, I wish I could help you more. I told her, Mom, you're done with your work. You did that when you were young. There's no need for you to do anything anymore. Grace adds that she considers her caregiving role a privilege, a way of giving back to them for bringing me into this world, even though it takes an emotional toll. The hardest part, she says, when her mother grows melancholy, the kids say, Mom, Grandma doesn't want to get out of bed. That really makes me sad because I think she's given up. I have no time. I have times where I'll just go in my room and be by myself, praying and talking to God, because I have to be strong. She's my mother. She's everything to me. Well, I won't say anything. Still turning pages. Hold on a second. Deeper in the magazine than I thought I was going to be. Okay. hospice, right for you or a loved one. 9 facts you need to know. An interesting thing happens when Dawn Gross brings up hospice to her patients or families. Oh no, we don't want that, they often say. Okay, Gross says, in a hospice and care position in San Francisco, tell me exactly what you don't want. We're sure not going to give you that. Going off to some facility, they tell her, losing control of care, being knocked out by morphine, or giving up. When Gross assures them the hospice isn't at all like that, 2/3 of the hospice care takes place in a person's home or long-term care facility, the patient can still receive medical care, and that Medicare, most insurers pay for it. They often change their minds. In 2011, about 1 million people died in the hospice. About 42% of those who died, according to the National Hospice and Care Organization, and its use is growing. Misconceptions about this end-of-life service abound. As a result, many who might benefit from it, hospice, don't sign up until the very end. About 1/3 of hospice users enroll for less than a week, and the median time is 18 days. So how can you tell whether hospice is the right choice for you and your loved one? The answer depends on what you believe hospice is and your goals and what you think you can or can't do. Here's what you need to know. Hospice is a philosophy of care, not a brick-and-mortar location. Most people say they want to die at home, but only about 1 in 4 do so. One big reason is they often just too hard trying to care for someone with a serious illness, especially at home. Without hospice, it's trying to have surgery without anesthesia. Hospice bring everything to you might need at home. Hospital bed, bedside commode, medications, bandages, expert consultations tailored to your needs. But if you're daunted by home care or simply don't want a loved one to die in your home, hospice can also be available at facilities and hospitals. Signing up doesn't mean giving up all medical care. Transitioning to hospice means shifting from one set of goals, how to get a longer life through a cure, to another, how to get the best quality of life out of whatever time is left. When people say, I don't want to give up, the key is to understand what they're giving up. Even when a cure is no longer viable, therapies that improve symptoms can raise comfort, and raised comfort can continue. I deliver very aggressive care in hospice. If, however, you feel that you've exhausted all your treatment options and search for a cure, hospice may not be for you. Medicare hospice rules require foregoing curative treatments. They may soon change, though. In June, Medicare announced the expansion of a 5-year program at 141 hospices in 40 states to allow patients to continue pursuing curative treatments while under hospice care. You have to qualify for hospice, but you can opt out at any time. To qualify for hospice benefits through Medicare or private insurance, 2 physicians must certify you have a life-altering condition with an expected lifespan of 6 months or less. This time frame is arbitrary, however, and there are no biological science basis for knowing how long you have left. If you start hospice and realize it's not for you, you can quit. How can you know when to try hospice? You should be part of an ongoing discussion with your health care team, because goals and needs change. You may live longer during hospice than the time you have left. Hospice recipients live longer on average than those receiving standard care. 2010 study of lung cancer patients found they lived nearly 3 months longer. Another study looking at the most common terminal diagnosis found that some, ranging from an average of 20 days for gallbladder cancer to 69 days for breast cancer. You can still see a regular doctor. A basic hospice team consists of a physician and nurse, both on call 24 hours a day, a social worker, counselor, chaplain and a volunteer. Most hospices offer added services, psychologists, psychiatrists, home health aides, art or pet therapist, nutritionist, occupational speech, massage, and physical therapist. However, they may also continue to see your regular doctor and remain in charge of your, and you may remain in charge of your medical decisions. The goal of pain management in hospice is to enable you to live well, not sedate you. People often mistakenly think pain medicines will make a person sleepy to the point where they can't interact. To the contrary, if you live with pain unnecessarily, it makes you more tired and irritable, robs you of your quality of life. Tell me about it. When drugs like morphine are used to treat anxiety and lessen pain, which has been shown to be undertreated at the end of life, it doesn't hasten death, as many people mistakenly believe. Hospice can enrich and sometimes salvage the last stage of life. Almost a third of terminal patients die in a hospital hooked up to machines that do little to halt the process of dying. Hospice is designed to support the personal aspects of this last stage, reflecting on one's legacy and life meaning. You're listening to my legacy right now, focusing on relationships in a deeper and more personal way, achieving a sense of closure, realizing many end-of-life goals, such as attending a grandchild's graduation or getting financial affairs in order. Hospice is for the entire family. It's not always easy to witness hallucinations of delirium or understand the body language of someone who can no longer speak, for example. A hospice nurse can help interpret what's happening or explain the signs of imminent death. When families need a break, the sick person can spend up to 5 days at a time at an inpatient care, such as nursing home or hospice facility. Hospice continues after death. Many people don't realize that optional follow-up grief support for 12 months is included under Medicare rules. For many of our families, their journey with hospice is only beginning once their loved ones die. Ultimately, hospice makes space for the spirit, love, and quieting of the mind that tend to be take precedence as the body prepares to shut down. We make a mistake in assuming that serious illness and dying are mostly medical. They're fundamentally personal. When choosing hospice care, is it accredited? Hospices aren't required to be certified or accredited, but those that seek outside accreditation are making special commitment to quality care. Has hospice been surveyed by states or federal oversight organizations? Affordable Care Act now requires hospices to accept Medicare, almost all of them, to complete surveys and provide data and several quality measures, including how well the patient's pain, even eventually the results will be made public online. For now, ask if a survey has been done and what the results show. Ideally, a hospice nurse or nurse practitioner should have no more than 12 patient visits each day. Hospices come in many sizes, although smaller ones provide more personalized care. Larger ones have more. Well, I guess that's our show for today. We'll continue tomorrow in this magazine. I'm only about halfway through with it. Thanks for listening. I hope you learned something, and see you next time. Bye.